This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And from stern evacuation warnings on a sunny Sunday afternoon to a rain and windstorm that built for an entire day, it was a hurricane, then it was a tropical storm, then it coined its own special meteorologic name, Superstorm Sandy, firmly parked itself over the East Coast. And on a morning 1 year ago, residents began to see how their communities had changed forever. At least 117 dead, thousands homeless, an estimated $65 billion in damage. The recovery continues even today. In the middle of an election campaign, the government was tested a year ago, as never before. The need for cooperation in the aftermath of Sandy as urgent as the storm itself. President Barack Obama appointed Sean Donovan, his Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, to help lead the federal response to Sandy. Secretary Donovan joins me now to assess the region's recovery 1 year after the storm. It's great to have you here.
John, it's great to be with you.
You got your control panel set there, your iPad. You're definitely in touch with what's going on because things are going on even as we speak.
Absolutely right. And look, if you'd asked me a year ago when I witnessed this destruction, and I'm a New Yorker, I have friends in Brooklyn who lost family members and their businesses, their homes. If you'd asked me a year ago, would we be as far along in the recovery as we are today? I would have been doubtful. But by Memorial Day, we had 97% of the beaches across the region open. There were 650,000 homes damaged, and the vast majority of folks are back in their homes, their business up and running. But there's still a lot of work to do. There are people still out of their homes, the most impacted. And perhaps most significantly, we have to work to make sure that a storm like this doesn't do this kind of destruction again. Climate change is here, and we have to be preparing for it as we go forward.
I'll talk about the preparation piece in a moment, but who's stuck? We've talked with people who are still waiting permits to raise their property that's basically condemned, but they can't get the permits necessary. Is there a problem with federal, state, local, city, county cooperation in managing this recovery in certain neighborhoods?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that there are really three stages to recovery for the homeowners that were most impacted. The vast majority of folks, they were able to get up to $30,000 from FEMA within a few weeks. That was often enough. Then the next step is they have to work with their insurance companies, and that was a difficult process for many, many families, but 99.5% of insurance claims have been paid. Now what's really left is the folks that were hit the hardest, that either have to completely replace their homes, that need to elevate them. And there, it really is, some of it is, it looks like red tape, but you know, we have to check if these are historic properties. We have to make sure that insurance companies paid everything they can, because we don't want federal taxpayers subsidizing private insurance companies. But also, one of the things that's been so important is to build to a new standard. The truth is, the maps that we were using for flood levels were 20 years outdated, and so we moved very quickly to give new information to communities, and that's, in a lot of cases, what folks are starting to adjust to get their building permits or other things that really do reflect a new level of risk that even though it's harder right now, we're going to rebuild in a way where the damage will be less next time.
A lot of that new map information is not welcome to real estate developers, to people who've traditionally wanted to create beachfront communities that have a sort of a high value proximity to the ocean. Is the federal government moving to a point where if it's that beautiful and you're that vulnerable, you're not going to get any help from the federal government? You're on your own here. Is that part of where we're headed?
Well, look, the president was very clear in his inaugural address for his second term. He talked about climate change as one of the most important things that we have to recognize. This summer, he released a climate action plan where one of the key three legs of the stool, if you will, was that we have to prepare our communities better for climate change. And so it doesn't mean that we can't live by the shore. There are places, Oakwood Beach and Staten Island and others, where, frankly, to buy out and turn that land back into natural land is the best answer. But in the vast majority of places, we can live safely with the water if we do smart things, if we elevate, if we protect, if we build our infrastructure stronger. And that's we have to take the time to do that. We're willing to invest in it. I awarded $5 billion more of community development block grant money that can help to make our communities more resilient. But we have to take the time to do that. And in the long run, despite the kind of resistance that you're talking about, which is, and there's no question, is there. It's better in the long run if we do things the right way now.
From your perspective, you know, we've been talking about housing and the housing problems in the wake of a disaster, of course, when everyone's really engaged and energized. But there are housing problems in the middle of Cleveland or in the middle of Detroit, in the middle of urban centers that are just recovering from the disaster of the 2008 financial meltdown.
The man-made disaster.
There you go.
Before the natural disaster.
How much of your work on Sandy is a distraction perhaps from some of those urban initiatives that the president also believes are very much important?
Well, as the president said, we've all got to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time on his team. So we continue to work on those. But what you had, sadly, with Sandy was the confluence of that man-made disaster with the natural disaster. We had thousands of families across the region who were struggling to pay their mortgages before they had to support not only their home but a rental apartment because they were out of their homes. And so one of the most important things that we did with my task force was to create a single policy that covered all federally insured mortgages, more than 90% of the mortgages across the region, that said, look, you can't foreclose. We put a moratorium on that. And then what we said was, you know, if folks are going to have to start paying again at some point, the problem is if they're going to have to catch up all at once, we're going to have another disaster on our hands. It's going to exacerbate the problems of foreclosure. And so we put in place for the first time ever a single policy that said, hey, you can come in, get your mortgage reworked so that your payments will actually be the same or less than they were before, even if there is money that you didn't pay over that time. So that was one of the important things. That's now going to become national policy because we did it for Sandy.
Secretary Donovan, do you advocate the cancellation or the revocation of federal mortgage subsidies for people who live in zones that are ultimately in harm's way, and elimination of the federal subsidy for coastal communities?
Well, one of the things that we said very clearly after this, for the first time, we set a federal standard across every single dollar that we're going to spend in recovery. If you were substantially damaged, you're not going to be able to get flood insurance help. You're not going to be able to get a federally insured mortgage going forward if you don't elevate your home or otherwise protect it to these new standards. And so some folks have said that's going too far. We believe it's the right thing to do to make sure this region is rebuilt so that the next time around – because let's recognize this. The 12 hottest years we've ever had in our history have happened in the last 15. This is not just an anomaly. Climate change is real, and we have to prepare our communities for these storms again.
Secretary Donovan, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Sean Donovan leading the team in the recovery from Sandy 1 year ago today. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. Is a disaster trying to tell you something? If you live in the path of a storm, in the wreckage of some fire or earthquake, does your home cease to be your home? For the people who chose to stay in places that seemed to be at risk now a year after Sandy arrived on the East Coast, home is still home. The same is true, though, even in places that have suffered disasters that we think of as moonscapes, toxic ghost towns, radioactive deserts. Chernobyl in the Ukraine is such a place, and people still call it home. The same is true at the tsunami-destroyed Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan. Photojournalist Michael Forster Rothbard went there to find out why people stay in such places, and he left with some real insights about his own ideas of home.
I was spending time in Ukraine, and my commitment to this project started when I realized how often journalists and photojournalists distort a story like Chernobyl. They come in just for a day or two, and they expect danger, they expect despair, and so that's what they photograph, that's what they write about. And they come away with these disturbing pictures of children with birth defects or abandoned buildings, and that's part of the story, of course, but that's not the full story. There is suffering, of course, but there's also joy and beauty. You don't suffer every single day of your life. And people have this amazing endurance and hope, and that's what I wanted to bring to light.
So what is the question that you really posed to people or occurred to you as you went to these places that in many ways and for most of us in the world are uninhabitable?
I ended up spending 2 years in Chernobyl actually living there. And what really fascinated me was finding out why people stay. I mean, there's probably as many reasons for staying as people I talked to, but really the themes I saw is for some it was a lack of alternatives, people feeling, yes, like that there was nowhere else to go. For many people, it's really the deep ties to the land. It's hard for us to understand in this country because we're so transient, but people who have lived in the same village, in the same house for generations are reluctant to move, and they'll even face a lot of hardships in order to stay put.
Do you think there's a universal answer to the question of why people stay in the path of Sandy in places like Chernobyl and Fukushima? Is there some psychological outlook that you can see in all three of those places and everywhere where people decide to stay?
It's interesting you ask that. I just had a conversation with the filmmaker Holly Morris, who's making a beautiful film about the Samosiele, the old woman who have remained in the exclusion zone. And she said that she thinks there's a force stronger than radiation, and that's the power of home. When we say home, that has such resonance to us because it has so many meanings, but it's sort of the emotional community we have, the community of people around us, and we're constantly uprooting and tearing apart those connections and then having to rebuild them. And so if you live all your life in one place, you'd choose to keep those connections rather than keep your own health. One woman I talked to said, I'd rather have 5 years of health in this place than 10 years of despair in the city.
Hmm. Do you envy that notion of home in your own life, so strong that it can face a disaster, radiation, tsunami?
Yeah, of course I envy that. When you love a place, you really hate to leave it. But if it changes so much that it's no longer recognizable, then maybe you're better leaving.
Michael Forster Rothbart's new TED book out this week is called Would You Stay? It's a look at the survivors of Chernobyl and Fukushima who dug in their heels after tragedy and stayed. Some of his images are also on exhibit this year in Connecticut.
Let me get right to the point then. I don't think you ought to go.
You can't lie in front of the bulldozers indefinitely.
I'm game. We'll see who rusts first.
If you're staying there, you're just stupid.
This is my hood, and I'm staying right here. I want to see what happens.
Darling, you gotta let me know. Should I stay or should I go?
That's the question. Why do people stay in disaster zones?
Hi, this is Emily from Charleston, South Carolina. I figured it can't all be good down here. We'll take a hurricane every 20 years for 19 great years in the meantime.
The risks are worth it, according to Emily. Thanks for that. From Everett, Washington, I live north of Seattle. We get high winds and flooding. The winds are only occasionally disastrous, and the flooding gets worse all the time as the area gets more developed. I will stay here as my kids and my life is here. I've been fortunate with weather. Let's hope it stays that way out there in Everett. I'm John Hockenberry. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE with your sense of home to weigh in on the reasons why we stay.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The Allies are outraged. You must have heard by now. They're mad as hell. Members of the European Parliament all crossing the pond looking to get a piece of the Obama administration, or at least members of Congress, demanding a better explanation or even an end to U.S. spying on European leaders. Here's Jan Philipp Albrecht, the German member of the European Parliament from the Green Party in Washington, D.C.
It's not outrageous to collect information about suspects, but it's outrageous to survey citizens' lives completely, to tap conversations and also to collect metadata. And it's leading to a society in which surveillance becomes normal practice. And I don't think, and we as Europeans don't think, that this is in line with rule of law and free democracy. And I think that trust is severely damaged and need to be restored. And that's very important.
Jan-Philipp Albrecht, a German member of the European Parliament. The White House has been backpedaling and studying the matter for months. It's trying to stay out in front of questions about U.S. policy regarding its considerable electronics eavesdropping capability and the seeming autonomous power of the National Security Agency, the NSA. Could the White House set strict limits on who the NSA watches or listens to, drawing a line at world leaders or allies or really good friends? How about American citizens? Well, since the Edward Snowden revelations, we have a much more disturbing picture of the NSA's reach. But Snowden has had help from the media, particularly The Guardian, the newspaper at the center of the leaks. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron.
What Snowden is doing, and to an extent what the newspapers are doing in helping him doing what he's doing, is frankly signaling to people who mean to do us harm how to evade and avoid intelligence.
My next guest, Louise Mensch, is a former Conservative member of Parliament, stands with Prime Minister David Cameron on this issue in studio with me. First of all, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think there is a conspiracy between Snowden and the media to undermine security, or is this about disclosure of disturbing allegations that people need to know about?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Snowden wasn't discriminate in what he stole from the NSA, the same as with Chelsea Manning. He didn't just take files about the NSA. He just took an indiscriminately enormous amount of files covering both NSA whistleblowing, you might say, but also the operations of allies such as Britain, Australia, Canada, and he just pretty much took everything. Then he gave it to WikiLeaks and a bunch of bloggers. So, of course, he's endangered not only American national security, but British national security and those of allies around the world.
So the indiscriminate nature of Snowden's disclosures is what disturbs you the most. You could see a case being made for certain disclosures selectively being made more transparent.
Definitely. I think, you know, if there had been genuine whistleblowing, we would have seen perhaps him challenging the oversight of the NSA and things like that. But that's not what he did. He went deep into the mainframe. He took everything he could get and he ran with it to repressive regimes like China and Russia. It's a little bit, it kind of sticks in the throat when this guy is portraying himself as a whistleblower and then he goes off to a homophobic, a repressive entity like Russia and gives them state secrets.
Your colleague, I suppose it's a loose way of saying, a German member of the European Parliament, an MP in Europe from the Green Party, so I can't imagine you agree on a lot of things. But Jan-Philipp Albrecht a moment ago said, we as Europeans don't think that surveillance as a normal practice is in line with rule of law and free democracy. There's a lot of cameras set up in London, I understand. Do you think surveillance has become normal in Europe?
Yeah, well, I hope Mr. Albrecht hasn't been on his Facebook recently because he might be disturbed by some of the ads that he's seeing. I think you have to understand that metadata collection is not the same as hacking everybody's phone, which is what the sort of ultra-left would have you believe. Metadata collection is completely normal. Google does it to you every day. And actually, the NSA's remit and mandate is that it spies on foreign powers. It's all very well, as he said, saying, let's spy on the terrorists. Unfortunately, I think anybody with a tiny modicum of common sense would know that you can't just say, we'll catch people for whom we have a warrant. Intel gathering has to be wider than that. And I think everybody knows it. Even he knows it.
Aren't there limits, though? I mean, to say it's common sense to just watch everybody because we know the bad people are people. So let's just watch all the people. That pretty much is a prescription for surveillance of everyone.
Well, I think if you look at, you know, general traffic and metadata gathering, it, as I said, with Google, with Facebook, it's pretty much going on all the time already. And it's quite normal to think that national intelligence agencies are going to be in the same business. You know, Glenn Greenwald, the so-called journalist who's been collaborating, distributing the Snowden information and working with
The Guardian.
He said yesterday, rightly, actually, that if European leaders were really concerned about this, they would be offering Ed Snowden asylum. And you don't really see Angela Merkel hasn't offered Edward Snowden asylum in Germany, probably because the German security services, I think we'll find, do the same thing. We found out earlier this year that the French security services have been gathering data on French nationals. So this is completely normal. And frankly, everybody does it.
European outrage, Angela Merkel's outrage, is a sham in your view?
I believe it's somewhat manufactured. She has to, because there's doubtless outrage on the German street. But at the same time, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. There's long been this Five Eyes alliance with spying in the Anglosphere. If they really cared about it, they would call up Vladimir Putin and say, hey, Ed Snowden is welcome in Berlin. But they haven't done that.
Louise Mensch, if we can do it, should we do it in terms of electronic surveillance? If I could put a camera on the back of your hoodie there and follow you home, would that be fine?
I think you have to really make the distinction between genuine surveillance, listening into people's phone conversations, as has been alleged, and metadata gathering.
Who's going to make that distinction?
Well, I think it's up to the security services, as licensed by Congress, to make that distinction.
They make it, not judges, not lawyers?
Well, they have oversight by the judiciary. They have it now. And I think ultimately the safety of the United States ought to be the primary concern of the president and the government.
Louise Mensch, former Conservative Member of Parliament, who agrees with David Cameron that The Guardian and the collaborators with Edward Snowden should be reined in on issues of disclosure of NSA metadata. Louise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. Now playing.
Now in Texas, some legislative change. A restrictive abortion law goes into effect today, but there have been some last-minute changes. Hours before the new law was set to go into effect, a federal judge blocked a key part of the abortion law, handing a partial victory to abortion rights activists. In the decision, the judge ruled that the law could not require doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. What does this mean? Joining us now is Veronica Zaragovia, who's been covering this story for KUT Austin, Texas. Veronica, welcome back.
Thank you so much, John.
What did the judge do? And from the perspective of young women in or women of any age in Texas, what does this mean?
What the judge did is he permanently blocked the provision that would require abortion doctors to receive admitting privileges at nearby hospitals from where they perform abortions. And what that means is that the 36 abortion clinics in Texas will continue to provide the service.
And so the hospital admission rights situation is not a reason for disqualifying doctors who perform abortions in clinics. That's basically the import of this judge's decision.
Correct, because based on the Supreme Court ruling in 92 with Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a state can't put an undue burden on a woman who is seeking an abortion. And hospitals aren't very keen. This is, you know, the argument that the plaintiffs made. Hospitals don't easily grant these privileges to people who don't, to doctors who don't bring a lot of clients. Abortion procedures don't cause a lot of hospital admissions. And so it would have forced these clinics to lose a lot of their staff and possibly close doors.
Well, it's a matter where the legislature is weighing into policy decisions that medical institutions might prefer to make on their own. There's another provision that the judge upheld in this case that, again, is a law trying to determine a protocol for doctors. Describe this drug protocol that also is affected by this decision.
So this provision requires doctors to follow the FDA regimen, which requires a higher dosage than what's accepted, what many doctors do And it also requires the patient to take the second dosage in the presence of the physician. What plaintiffs argue is that that causes a woman in Texas to make up to 4 visits to an abortion clinic because of a previous law in Texas, the sonogram law, where you also have to make 2 visits because of that. So the judge found, however, that following FDA protocol doesn't cause an undue burden to a woman seeking an abortion because she can choose to have a surgical abortion. So that's effective today.
So the net effect of this law is to really increase the difficulty, the number of trips that are required to the doctor, and whether the judge believes that FDA requirement is valid or not. The intent of this law is to make it harder for women to get abortions in Texas, and in that, at least in this particular drug protocol, they've succeeded. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. With that provision, they have succeeded. The plaintiffs are concerned, and they say they're monitoring how this will play out. However, the state is not content with the judge's decision regarding the hospital admission privilege, and they filed an emergency stay with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. And so we'll have to see if that emergency stay is granted, and that means that they will block the judge's decision on that provision.
Well, waiting for the courts to rule once again. Veronica Zaragovia covering the story of the abortion law in Texas for KUT Austin. Veronica, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Are the priorities changing in the Middle East? In a speech to the United Nations General Assembly last month, President Obama laid down a new set of foreign policy principles and priorities, in addition to talking about mitigating the strife in Syria.
In the near term, America's diplomatic efforts will focus on 2 particular issues: Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons and the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Now, the Arab-Israeli conflict involves the nation of Egypt on some level, but Egypt was not mentioned by name. Is it missing from the president's list of top priorities, the instability and political crisis that still goes on in Egypt? Is that not a concern of U.S. national interest? Joining me to discuss this is Michael Waheed Hanna, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Michael, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Does the U.S. Consider Egypt a player in the Arab-Israeli conflict right now, or sort of out to pasture because of its own political problems?
Probably a bit of both. The relationship, in terms of the very close bilateral relationship, is really an outgrowth of the 1973 October War. And that relationship has always been underpinned with relations with Israel, particularly post-Egypt-Israel peace treaty. That equation, I think, is probably outdated. But clearly, regional security, Egypt's role in regional security and relations with Israel are part of the backdrop in how the United States conceives of its relationship with Egypt.
To not mention Egypt, does that suggest tacitly that the U.S. believes that General al-Sisi, who is in control right now, has no intention of doing anything to change the status quo regarding the peace treaty with Israel?
I think that's been clear. It was clear under the Muslim Brotherhood. The Egypt-Israel peace treaty exists for its own reasons, out of Egypt's national interests, and I think it's fairly stable. And I think that should be set aside in terms of really the fundamental dynamics of U.S.-Egypt relations. That peace treaty is not going anywhere.
So then a really cynical view of the president's apparent omission here is to basically note that the Obama administration kind of got it wrong, staying with Mubarak way too late, got it wrong endorsing Morsi without really seeing what the underpinnings were of that politics, and has no idea what to do under these circumstances. So they're throwing up their hands.
I think that's right. The posture of the United States at the moment with Egypt is one of ambivalence and uncertainty. And in light of those circumstances, it makes sense that they are not highlighting Egypt as a mainline policy initiative, because really this is a set of issues that has really no good answers and options. And even at this point, I think Egypt policy is in flux. And I think decision points are nearing. But at the moment, I think there's still some leeway, and that policy isn't fully iterated at the moment.
Well, trying to figure out what is going on in Egypt is certainly the focus of anyone in Egypt, as well as Middle Eastern experts outside, including Michael Wahid Hanu, who I'm speaking with now, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. In this context, is there a vacuum? Are the Saudis increasing their interest and influence in supporting the military inside Egypt?
They've increased their support, and there's obviously a convergence of interest between the current military-led political order and the Saudis, who have a longstanding enmity with the Muslim Brotherhood. But it's hard to argue that the Saudis' influence has increased dramatically.
They're writing bigger checks than the U.S. is in terms of aid.
Absolutely. And they are a key ally to Egypt at the moment. But that's a function of the fact that they see the world in the same way that this current political order does. They don't have leverage in the sense of being able to boss Egypt around. This is a convergence at the moment of interests.
Finally, around the edges, is the Sinai stable? Is the chance for sectarian violence in cities outside of Cairo still an option?
Both of those things. Sinai is not stable. There is a low-level insurgency there, attacks on police and army on an almost daily basis. And obviously, sectarian relations have worsened since Mubarak and the opening of a security vacuum, and that has continued to deteriorate since the ouster of Morsi.
Michael Wahid Hanna, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The world has witnessed revolutionary change in Egypt since 2011 and 2012 when Hosni Mubarak's dictatorship ended, and right now the nation seems poised once again between chaos and a resumption of military rule. The massive protests on the 30th of June this year that removed President Mohamed Morsi and replaced him with another general, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Can Egypt change for the good, make good on its promises of democracy and freedom? Can Egypt really change? It's the question for two young Egyptians who recently visited our studios.
I think that we need to find the common ground or the place that we can agree more than that we disagree so we can move forward.
The struggle is not about who's in control and who's not. We have to be together and work together, and whoever comes in control, that would be the choice of people.
27-year-old Mohamed Mubarak is an architect. He was joined by rising young star woman lawyer in her 20s named Moga Morsi. Mubarak and Morsi. An irony, not a joke. But these two young people hold the hope of their country in their hearts and minds.
Nowadays, I think my country is going in the wrong direction. I think about the 30th of June as a coup. It doesn't mean that I'm pro the MBs or that I used to like the old regime of Mohamed Morsi. I'm against it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about MBs means Muslim Brothers.
Yeah.
Right.
Brothers.
You would call them Ikhwan
Muslimin. Yeah.
Right. Do you think this process has delegitimized them completely, or should they have a role in Egyptian politics moving forward?
I don't think they're a minority. I think they have a lot of followers, and they should be represented in the political regime in Egypt.
And Mohamed Mubarak, what allegiance do you have?
I'm not part of any political parties or anything, but I'm actually completely with what happened in Egypt during the 30th of June. It is the will of the people. People went to the streets by millions, so you can't call it a coup. Or actually, personally, I don't care about the names. Is it a coup or a revolution or whatever? It's the people demand at the end. So I feel like the military did what people wanted them to do.
And you don't go along with that?
Yeah. I'm also against Mohamed Morsi's regime, and I was against his ruling. But I thought that this wasn't the right way to get rid of him. I thought that there must be another way that was as democratic as the elections or something, maybe a referendum or something about should he stay at power or not.
I have to disagree with that, because whatever happened, we should move forward. We should look for the future. People actually care more about their living status. They want food, they want electricity, gas, and oil. So we should work together to make a better Egypt.
And Moga?
I totally agree with Mohammed. We should move forward and we should cooperate. But my only concern is about who will rule Egypt in the next elections.
Who do you think should rule Egypt? What kind of person do you think should rule Egypt? I hear Mohammed Mubarak talking very calmly about let's settle down. That seems
totally
to suggest that the military is going
to
come in and calm everything down. What are the passionate voices that you hear that you'd like to hear?
That's the biggest problem, that we don't have an alternative about who should rule Egypt or who should now...
Well, if you're talking about democracy, so people who should decide who will rule Egypt.
Yeah, I agree. But let's hear the voice that you want to hear. Let's just say you're speaking to the people of Egypt right now on this program and you're running for the parliament. Make the argument that you think people need to hear to get the passion back into politics, because there's so much sense of oppression and disillusionment in Egypt right now. And I'll ask you the same question, Mohammed.
I think that we should not eliminate anyone. We should just cooperate again to sit on one table and talk about the real problems and where are the points that we can intersect again.
And the role of Islam, what is that?
The majority of Egyptians are Muslims, so... I go for the moderate Islam.
So a moderate program for you. Will there be military members of your cabinet?
Yes, there will be.
And the peace treaty with Israel, do you support that or would you want to re-examine that?
No, I go with it. We cannot do anything with Camp David nowadays.
Mohammed Mubarak.
Well, over the last years, many years, even before the step down of Mubarak, people actually lost faith in politicians. People, you know, support Sisi right now, the general,
right.
The general Sisi right now, and how much you see his pictures in the streets and songs written to him. So you can find that how much he's very popular now in Egypt.
All right, so Mr. Mubarak, you would support the military in your government. Would you have someone from the Muslim Brotherhood in your cabinet?
Yeah, if he's not violent, he's not having this ideas of...
extremist ideas.
Yeah, he's not an extremist. Yeah, I would definitely do that.
Would there be women in your government?
Sure.
The role of Islam?
The role of Islam actually is a way of life. It's not just a religion. It's a religion and a way of life. So you cannot say the role of Islam. It's very homogeneous with the lives in Egypt, even the life of Christians in Egypt.
And finally, would you support the peace treaty with Israel?
I would support that, but as well as I will reevaluate it.
Reevaluate it?
Yeah.
Will you take aid from the United States?
I don't really care about it. And I think this is the case in with most of the Egyptians. Most of them, when the United States announced they will suspend the subsidy for the military, most of Egyptians actually said that we don't need it. We don't need to give
it. They were happy.
They were happy. They were happy that they suspended it because it's a sign of, you know, of some kind of... it's an independence for us. We are not a following country. We are not following any country.
All right. Americans have viewed the Arab Spring. They've seen this sort of, heroic democracy. The people are in the street. They're going to throw off the dictator. Things are going to change. Egypt's going to be very, very different. And then we see what happened with some say it's a coup and a change in leadership. I think most Americans would look at your country and say, you folks aren't ready for democracy. Sorry. I don't know what you're doing, but you're not ready for democracy. So call us when you are. What would you tell them?
I actually will tell them that democracy is not one thing that has a definition about if you want to do democracy, this is one, two, or three steps you have to do. For my belief, democracy is about the people and their lives, how make their lives better. This is democracy. We invented civilization, so it's very, very...
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so it's very hard to tell us that we are not ready for democracy.
I think it's... it need time, but we are on it, and we will, in a way or another, reach this. There's no other option than reaching this.
Young lawyer Moga Morsi and her friend and colleague, although they sometimes disagree, architect Mohammed Mubarak. They're both visiting the U.S. as Shafiq Gabber Fellows, a program that invites 10 Americans and 10 Egyptian young leaders to travel Egypt and the U.S. together and work on projects to promote cross-cultural understanding.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
so many questions a year after Sandy, some psychological, some meteorological, all scientific, and with us is perhaps the best person to pose some of those questions to, Ira Flatow, host of Public Radio International's Science Friday. Ira, welcome.
Thank you, John.
I'll postpone the psychological questions for the moment. When we think of meteorology, weather, are we really talking about climate and the idea of severe storms being a climate phenomenon, or are they one-offs?
No, this is the new normal. I mean, Sandy is a perfect example of what was predicted, how it would work, and it actually came to fruition the way everybody thought it would.
And is this because there's more energy in the environment, so therefore storms are bigger, or are the patterns of the atmosphere itself disrupted in some way? They're coming from different places.
Well, if you raise the temperature just a tiny little bit, then a lot of things kick in. You have warmer water. So you have more energy that comes out of the water to feed a hurricane. Winter storms, Mary, raise the temperature a little bit. Look at all these snowstorms that have been tremendous, dropping all kinds of storms, snow everywhere. Doesn't mean just because of we're getting warmer, doesn't mean it's going to stay warm everywhere during the wintertime. It just means there's more moisture in the air. And when you have a hurricane, there's more moisture, there's more rain, and the hurricane itself is much wider. People don't remember that Sandy really was not a hurricane level when it hit New Jersey, when it slammed in there. It was not a hurricane force, but it was so big and so wide and so powerful that it created a tremendous amount of damage without having to have those giant, you know, type 5 winds.
Well, the struggle of them trying to figure out how to describe it. I mean, it wasn't a hurricane. They called it Superstorm Sandy,
right,
which seemed, you know, silly, because really it mostly said they don't understand this phenomenon. It's fundamentally new. And one of the issues that was really standing out to me was the fact that this storm kind of parked itself.
Yeah.
That the atmosphere, it now contains these walls, high-pressure systems that stick,
yeah,
and keep storms over places for longer periods of time. That's as much a problem as anything.
Yeah, it took a left turn. You know, hurricanes don't usually take a left turn as they're coming up the coastline. They go out toward, you know, Nantucket or someplace. But there was another front to the left of it that sort of sucked it in and made it take a left turn. But the Europeans, who were coming up with computer models, actually predicted this pretty well, that it would do this. The American model was not that accurate, but the European model was a little more accurate and predicted it days in advance that this would be the track that would be taking. So that was one of the lessons that was learned from this, is how accurate our forecasting is getting to be.
We think of turbulent weather and severe weather to be about storms, but it's also about persistent high systems, high-level systems,
yeah,
that park and produce,
yeah,
droughts and create dryness. We're also seeing that in this climate change model.
Yeah, we're seeing record dry. We're seeing record temperatures. I mean, record temperatures everywhere. In Australia, even, we don't think of those parts of the world. Australia last summer had to add another color to its temperature chart because it couldn't get up. You couldn't register 120, you know, Fahrenheit on its chart. So I'd added purple in there to show how hot it was getting in Australia. We also didn't think very much about storm surge. That's really where the damage was done in Sandy on the East Coast, was that you had the sea level was rising 14 feet in New York City. And it opened up places that it had went to places that storms had never gone before. And now that those places have been opened and the landscape has been changed, other storms are going to imitate that. And it will be easier now. You won't need a Sandy to flood and inundate those places.
There's some elementary physics associated with a storm surge, in the sense that a big surge coming off of a beach, if it's channeled up a narrow estuary, can multiply its force, and that's what we saw in communities all around New York and New Jersey.
Yeah, you had really a perfect storm situation, because if you recall, it came ashore at high tide. So you had this super storm surge, then you had high tide, then you had the water being channeled, and then the water created new channels. people talk about, okay, what should we do about this? Is there a technological fix? Well, sometimes some scientists are saying the fix could be worse than the storm. People had talked about building gates, you know, things that would hold the water back in New York Harbor. Well, you're just moving the water to some other place. You know, you're going to push it into Staten Island if you try to block the water, and you're not going to be able to do it.
And that's what they've discovered on the Mississippi River. The more jetties and walls they've created on the Mississippi River means when it does reach flood stage, the pressure is higher in those places that don't have those walls, so they flood more.
And all this money, there, you know, the government allocated $51 billion for reconstruction. A lot of people want to just put the sand back, and what they don't understand is that there will be more storms that will just keep moving the sand away. Coastline scientists are saying it's going to happen over and over again. It's like standing with your rolling up your pants and standing in a river. You may escape that rising water this time, but it's going to come back. And the real answer is a long-term solution of moving people away from the coastline. Okay, you can put them up on stilts for a little bit, but then we're in an age where the ocean is rising, and it's rising more and more. You're just pushing, you're kicking the can down the road, as we like to say these days.
And it's a wet can, that's for sure. You know, earlier this hour, Sean Donovan, Housing and Urban Development Secretary, was describing the challenges of the federal government trying to figure out what is the responsibility when people live in harm's way. And then we had a conversation with a photographer who sees in disaster zones that people's sense of home is so powerful. They do things that are against their interests. Yeah. Scientifically, do you think we can convince people to do the things that are in their best interest?
Well, it's a question of politics, and it's a question of money. Because if you keep doing this over and over again, if you keep spending money to rebuild these areas because people want to live there, they want their restaurants there, and they want to have their oceanfront homes, then you're sucking money into it from other places you might want to spend. Other things will be maybe your school systems, maybe other kinds of projects you'd like to spend the money on. Now you have to allocate it to putting the beach back, reconstructing the boardwalk, things like that. So it's a question of politics and money.
New York City in the turn of the century didn't have much of an ocean view. We were afraid of the water. The 1800s, 1700s taught us to be afraid of the waterfront. Now in our kind of gentrified, we love the view sort of new culture in New York, we're really discovering why our ancestors were terrified of the Hudson.
They were. And it's a question people are asking now. My tax money pays for you to rebuild your home. Federal insurance allows you to rebuild your home. They're beginning to ask, why should I be paying for you to have that oceanfront view when I don't, you know, I can't even get to the beach myself?
Not a scientific question, but certainly a political question. Ira Flatow, host of Public Radio International's Science Friday. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
So is nature scaring you in your neighborhood? Why do you stick around?
My name is Christy Davis. I'm calling from Martinez, California. My area, at least the Bay Area, is prone to earthquakes. I don't know, it doesn't really scare me that there's earthquakes. I just consider it a piece of Mother Nature reminding us that, hey, I'm going to wiggle and shake, and it's just kind of a natural thing that's happening. I like earthquakes. They're actually kind of exciting.
The wiggling and shaking there. One of our listeners, Christy, loves that. We got this from Florida. South Florida is Hurricane Central, but we stay for the same reason that most people stay. We like it here. Good climate, friends and family, and very important, stable jobs. It's all about that sense of home, more powerful than Mother Nature. We'd love to know your story. Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.